bull with a pitchfork and one.
You mean you actually had a bull mad at you?
Go ahead.
Oh, shoot. You want me to tell a story or what?
I just have to test it to be sure. You know, Mr. Meek, as bright as he was.
You can be licked sometimes. You have to check everything.
Yeah, you got to check it. Or else you work yourself to death and won't have anything to show for.
Oh, isn't that a shame?
No. These boys, you know, these things, you had 6 postgraduate courses.
Yes, different things that were responsible jobs.
Yeah.
But very little pay.
Yeah.
You know, $60 a month. Started as farm foreman with the experimentation farm in charge of livestock and field crops in the dairy.
Yeah.
And $60 a month. And said, well, I've been working before I was finished my 2-year course in agriculture. I was working for $1 a day, so I guess this isn't so bad. This is $2. Well, I could give you tell you about that bullfight I had.
Yeah, say about it.
Well, I was just stepping out of the dairy farm, and I heard my old faithful Negro shout in distress. And we had a dairy bull that when he was a yearling, he got one of the professors down and tried to horn him, and he didn't have horns, but he was that mean. Then he had big, sharp horns, and he was about to kill that old, faithful, dependable Negro I had in his hand.
Big Jersey bull?
Jersey. And that bull was just about to get him. He was in the feed trough, and that bull wasn't always in a bad humor, but usually. And he was about to get him. And he'd have killed him in a minute, I think, if I had less than half a minute, if I hadn't happened to step out. There was a pitchfork. And I couldn't tell you yet how I got over the fence, but
yeah.
I was over the fence charging for that bull to save the Negro.
Yeah.
And when he saw me, he whirled around and charged me head on.
Yeah.
I braced myself right quick. I was only 21 then. I was agile.
Uh-huh.
And so as soon as he got within range, I ran that pitchfork in his nose, so deep flat of his nose, till the bone stopped me.
Yeah.
And braced myself and held on. Well, then he couldn't get to me. It hurt too bad. Come on.
Yeah. In his nose?
In his nose, the flat of his nose. I was there quick
yeah.
with that fork, you know, because he was charging.
Yeah.
So round and round, he wouldn't give up. He danced around and round, tried to get away from that pitchfork and get to me, but he couldn't make it. I found out then that I had him, but I never thought of that before.
Yeah.
Anyway, there was a job to do.
Yeah.
And I did what I could about it. So then when I saw I had him, after a while, after he danced around 3 or 4 times, trying to get to me, and I held him tight. Then I jerked it out of his nose, stuck him in the ribbon, just before he got to me again, it was in the flat of his nose, deep.
Oh.
Till the bone shot me every time.
Oh.
You don't fool with an animal like that.
Oh,
so he didn't mind being rammed into the nose. That didn't faze him. But when
what?
I stuck him in the ribs, that made him mad. That discouraged him.
Oh, really?
You know, the bovine is vulnerable. If it's horned in the ribs, that could be deadly, or
yeah.
in the flank, that
yeah.
could be deadly. They realize that.
Oh, I see.
So the third time I stuck him in the ribs, he turned tail and ran.
Yeah.
And I chased him around the lot 3 times to make sure he understood.
Why, Mr. Nealon, I never heard anything like that.
Well, it's exactly the way I told it. But I had a problem there. Well, I don't want to be over. When I came there, we never saw a Negro in California.
Yeah.
And like everyone else in the North and the West that don't know anything about them, I was told that we abused them in the
yeah.
South. Oh, they're terrible with them. They don't treat them right. Well, I hadn't been here long enough, 3 years, to learn anything. I'd been connected with them. Down in our little wilderness farm there, we were none. That we cleared up new ground, you know, Pat says, with the hand of man never yet has set foot.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that I had no experience. So when I got in charge of these 15, 16 Negro men, I treated them just as if they were gentlemen, just as if I had ever spoke rough to them, just was very gentle with them. And they noticed that right away, that I was a Yankee or somebody from, didn't know anything about them. And so I hadn't been there more than about 2-3 months, maybe less than that. For we needed to get some hay in the barn. The rain was threatening, it was only half dry. And I'd sent both wagons out there with the hand to pile it on and bring it in, and then we'd scatter it in the hayloft out wide where it could finish curing in the barn. So this big Negro there, I showed him how I wanted it scattered. Wesley Johnson. I said, Wesley, you're not scattering that hay like it. You know, they just move it this far no more. That's the easiest way. I said, you ain't scattering that hay like I told you. You're going to do it.
Oh, really?
Oh boy.
He told you.
I hadn't been in the lumber camps and ranches for 2-3 years. I left home at 17 for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I grabbed me a pitchfork and I said, God damn your soul, you want me to ram this in your tail? I didn't say tail. Or are you going to pitch that hay like I told you? Yes, the boss. Yes, the boss. Yes, the boss. I had no more trouble than that. So you have to learn quick sometimes.
Yeah.
And the rest of them, they told that. Then it wasn't but a week or 10 days before I had that fight with the bull with Anson. And I know what the hand said. That man, he bad. No, I treated him right, always, and paid him every cent and looked after all their needs, if there were any, but what I said had to go, and they had to understand, and I think I got it across.
Yeah.
But sometimes when people don't do right, especially if you're 21, you're not going to take it easy.
Yeah.
And I think I did the right thing to this day, because unless you establish authority, you're not.
Tell me about your jobs, Mr. Neal.
Oh.
Like
it takes too long. We've already taken 20 minutes.
Well, take 5 minutes.
About
most of the time I was working on this.
About the different things I did?
Oh, yes.
Well, that begins on a ranch in California, a fruit farm.
Yeah.
And we raised fruit there, peaches and figs and apricots, and about 28 acres of vineyard. But
Is that where you were brought up?
That's where I was brought up. And along about 1906 and 7, the gold dredgers moved in there. When my folks homesteaded in the 80s there, that land was sold to them with a water right. And without water from May till November, there's not a cloud in the sky there. And everything dries up on the range. So the gold dredgers moved in there, and they could pay 5 or 6 times more for water than the farmer could afford to pay with the prices he got.
Mm-hmm.
So our water was diverted. The entire community withered up and blew away. Everything that had been built up in 20 years was gone. Was on the way out, so went to court about it. Took the lower courts 2 years to decide. It was a breach of contract. They were compelled to furnish us water, the corporation was. Well, the corporation appeals to a higher court, and Dad said, we're already half ruined, and it'll take the higher court 3 years to decide. It probably will, costing us money, and we'll be ruined anyway. Said, I hear it rains enough in Florida. We don't have to irrigate. We're moving to Florida and left everything. Beautiful place. People would stop along the highway and come in to buy some fruit. And say, you folks living in a paradise here, because this was the first place in the hills that was cultivated, and all the rest would be dry, and the rain, grass all dead, you know, will in summer. So we moved into Florida and dug palmetto roots and stumps on new ground.
Yeah.
Now I told that.
But I've dug palmetto roots enough to know what it is.
It's tough going.
Oh,
And these were big ones in the flatwood. Long trails, 7 or 8 feet long.
Yeah.
And you had to get you a sharp hazel hoe and cut all the branch, the roots. They're just as tough as rawhide
yeah.
to go down and then pry them out.
Yeah.
And stumps, I remember one double big pine stump. It took me a day and a half to dig it out. The hole was bigger than this room. So that was hard going, but I told Dad, farming is so different here. I better go and take that to short course at the university in agriculture. They let a man in like me with an 8th grade
mm-hmm.
certificate and no more than that. They let the lawyers in with the same thing in those
days. Yeah.
So I took the 2-year course and then went back to the farm. And so
when was that?
That was in 1913. So I hadn't been there but a few months before they wrote me and said they offered me the job as farm foreman on the experimentation farm. Well, I said, Dad, well, I seem to be needed around here. Well, he says, we'll get along. Maybe it'll mean something to you, so you go ahead. So I worked at that until World War I broke out. And then I went down. All the Negroes were down there, the whole crew of them. There must have been 20. Where I usually assigned them their jobs every morning. I said, boys, this is the last day for me. I'm leaving now, right now, for the war. And there'll be somebody else in charge here after this. And they all looked gloomy and said, ain't never going to get a boss man like Mr. Dealand again. So that encouraged me because they did appreciate proper and just handling.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that was after this bull episode.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
2 years after.
Yeah,
after.
Yeah.
So,
They would appreciate that bull episode.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And they'd appreciate that pitchfork with that colored man. They appreciate that.
Or you think they would?
They got a white man's point of view. They did then have.
Well, yeah, they found out that there was no traveling. And my background in ranches, you know, out west in the lumber camps, if you question anything, you get your orders from the logger, and you do exactly what he said, and you don't say if, and, or but.
Yeah.
And so when I ran into that thing there, that just fired me right up.
Yeah.
I would have done the same anywhere.
Uh-huh.
So I came there and studied that, and then I worked there. And then when the war broke out, of course, I went to war 2 years.
2 years?
With Uncle Sam's fighting fleet.
Yeah.
And we sailed all the seas, 14 trips across the Atlantic and up in the Arctics. And the Mediterranean was full of subs. We had our guns trained. We hugged the shore so close there couldn't be any subs on the shore side, and the guns trained out to sea. But I often told the boys, they're not after us. They're not after American ships. An English ship would come. Well, the entire Mediterranean was dotted with masts sticking out of the water where they got torpedoed and ran into shore where they sank in shallower water. We'd see a British ship half submerged heading for shore, and we'd go on, never see a thing. I guess it's just luck. But anyway, and the war was over, I came back, and Dad's health had failed. He had this low-ground asthma. I came back on a furlough one night, and New York was a home port, and they gave me 3 days off after being off 3 months. So I came home at 10 o'clock, and you're sitting at a table zipping a little kerosene, and you said if I lay down, I'd choke immediately. I couldn't breathe. But this kerosene sort of leaves my throat, and I said, this war's over, I'm coming home, take this piece of ground over, and you go back to the hills where you can breathe. And so I did. Well, I hadn't been there but about 6 weeks before. They said, we need a county agent in this county. You're the only qualified man. It didn't occur to them they might go to outside the county and get
yeah.
a better man.
Yeah, yeah.
What people in those days made do with what they had.
Mr. Nealon, it makes a big difference. It makes a big difference. If a fellow who grows up here, you see, if they look to him, it makes a big difference.
That seems
yes,
to.
It makes a big difference. And but
so,
now, you see, they don't do that anymore. They just shop around everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
They don't care where the county agent is.
As long as they got a certain degree, that's all they require now.
Yeah.
And good Lord. Lord knows you need more than that. Well, I had a pretty rough time there because I wrote to Gainesville and I said, well, what are my duties? Gainesville supervises. They said, put your finger on the most important thing and go to work. And that was brief and to the point.
Yeah.
So I did. Well, I had a good course in veterinary science here. Among the other things, I could select many of the subjects. I took more agriculture by far than the four-year man ever could take because I wasn't bothered with spherical trig and things that.
Yeah, yeah.
So the farmers themselves, they didn't think much of that. The college boy, you know, nothing. But that veterinary science helped me in a good many ways because one time, for instance, in my Model T, $120 a month, buy a car and run it from daylight to dark, no office necessary. Things were primitive then. Well, he called me up, we had a farmer's loan, and I was a telephone tycoon one time. The Southern Bell couldn't keep the line up, the collections were poor, the service was poor. Finally, the area man came down and he said, I want you to take over that line. I want you to buy that telephone line. I said, I got no money to invest at all. I'm just struggling alone to pay bills. Well, he says, don't say anything till I give you my proposition. He says, 14 miles of line, 25 instruments, and 3 bushels of insulators, 2 miles of wire. And he said, I'll sell you the whole thing for $1 and I'll lend you the dollar.
Oh, Mr. Neiman.
Well, I said, I hate to have you lend me the dollar. Here's the dollar. We needed that line because every once in a while someone gets sick and you need to call each other. And I had to sometimes rush somebody with an accident to the Daytona to the hospital. All kind of didn't work.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that right?
You had to be of service, that's all, in order to establish yourself. Well, one evening late, this fellow called up and said, my cow, my only milk cow, got into a barrel of potatoes and is about to die. Well, I said, hold on, I'm coming down. It's only about 2 miles away from home. I jumped my Model T and ran down there. Here this poor old cow standing there blown up like a balloon, just weaving. If she'd ever fallen, she'd ruptured internally, of course.
Yeah.
She is just so terribly bloated. Well, I don't have a trocar and cannula, which is what you're supposed to have. But here's the hip bone, and here is the rib bone. Here's a slight elevation back in the rear end. Out with my knife, popped it in there as deep as the blade would go, and gave the blade a twist. Sounded like a policeman's whistle. Bits of potatoes flew up 6 feet high.
Why, Mr. Neiman?
And that cow deflated immediately, and 10 minutes later walked off all right. Well, it's things like that. Maybe there is some use in the critter. See, they finally decided maybe we could keep him around.
Yeah. Well, now, what did you do? What did that do?
Oh, it just released that terrible pressure inside. See, the gas formed in there and no escape until it was blocked there. It couldn't escape. And
well, it would grow back?
Grow back?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, just small hole, you know. The same thing is done, we were taught in veterinary elements, with a trocar and cannula. A trocar is a handle, looks like a long, big punch, about as big as your little finger, and it works in a tube. And you punch the whole thing down until you reach the air pocket. Then you pull out your plunger, and the tube keeps the thing open. I had to keep it open by keeping my knife twisted so it let the air out. And then we release the pressure, and that all heals up.
Well, now, what does that go into there?
It goes into one of the main stomachs, the paunch.
Yeah, and it would heal up all right.
It all healed up, and the cow never noticed she'd been hurt.
So all she needed was to relieve that gas.
Relieve that terrible pressure, which would have killed her.
Yeah, it's a wonder, yeah. lasted that long.
Well, it's things like that. Then I had to vaccinate all the hogs in the county. That was a new thing. Serum was free, but the virus that you have to see, you have to inoculate with the disease and then with the serum that controls the disease. They all get the cholera, but they got the serum that will, eliminate the virus from being active. Well, anyway, sometimes that was real hazardous because most of those old backwoods farmers made their living with cattle in the woods and wild hogs in the swamps.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their living.
Yeah.
So when the cholera began to wipe them out, why, that was serious. So
mm-hmm.
they established down by the swamp big log traps and they baited it with corn and then they caught those wild hogs and I had to get in there and vaccinate them and some of them big tuskers, you know, they were mighty dangerous and you had to vaccinate every one because those that were vaccinated would inoculate those that were not. So you had to be careful. Remember this old tusker in there, he was the last one. He was a meanie and nobody, and I had a stout farm boy that was helping me and you couldn't go in there, he'd kill you. So he got him a little rope and with a loop on it and tried to get a loop around him snout. And as soon as that rope got in range, he grabbed that loop of the rope and he gave it a snatch and he had it across one of his tusks, so he held him. You know how a hog is, if you pull on him and have him by the ear or by the head, he doesn't know anything but to rear back. So while he was rearing back, I stuck him fore and aft with the needle and got him inoculated.
But you was in there with him.
But I had to be in there with him. And so the boy, the young man, strong young fella, he had the rope on the outside. But now how to get that rope out? That was the problem. So he poked and he fooled around and he finally he got in there with him. He had to get in there with him, but the hog was all pulling back, so he knew he was relatively safe. But when he got it loosened up enough, he smart too, so that he could give it a jerk and it would come out. And then he jumped for the tallest pole there for the hog pen, and that old boy climbed up there after him, didn't miss the seat of his pants a quarter of an inch with a tusk.
Why,
he got out. So it was kind of dangerous with those wild hogs at the time. It wasn't too easy. But what tickled me when I first started vaccinating, one of the farmers, somebody told me this, I wasn't there. He said, you know, yeah, he vaccinated all of mine, didn't kill one of them. You see, they're primitive people. You know,
yeah.
Understand about them. Well, enough said, but I had lots of experience there. Oh, that isn't much of anything. I had a lot of other things that came up.
What'd you do next?
Well, after that, I organized and ran a farmer's co-op for 3 years.
Yeah.
Well,
now, in my
why did I do that? They said, put your finger on the most important thing and go to work. Well, I said, what's the most important thing here? Hadn't been there long. I just got back from the war. And I said, why are these farmers losing their little 10 and 20 acre farms so much? Well, I started looking in on that. I checked on what they all borrowed from a factor or from the bank, either one, to finance them for their gamble on potatoes. Early Irish potatoes, the principal crop in the county.
Now, where was that?
Flagler County.
Oh, is that in the Flatwoods?
Across the Flatwoods, most of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, what is your cost? I found out that those poor buggers were paying 40% on 90-day money. You can't make any money farming on 40% on 90 days. That's as long as it makes the crop.
Mm.
So, oh well, the factors that furnished them said it's a hazardous business. We have to charge that. $15 a ton above the market for fertilizer takes a ton to the acre. $1 a sack, 5 sacks to the acre. for seed potatoes above the market, fair price, bank told me, and dust and other equipment the same, barrels. They sold potatoes, early our potatoes, in 175-pound barrels in those days. Well, so I said, well, nobody can make any money that way. Maybe I can make a contribution by getting a better buying and selling operation. I drove my Model T to every bank. The local bank scorned me. Every bank scorned me. We wouldn't lend you any money on any kind of agriculture paper. And I said, I guess that finishes that. But it wasn't long after that, the bank in Crescent City across the lake, starting a new bank there. Willard Warner was one of the fellows that went broke on potatoes there back in 1910-11. And he was working for the old banker there, and the old banker was getting behind in many ways. He wasn't keeping up, so Willard started a new bank in Crescent City. And as soon as I heard that, I went over there. And he lent me $25,000 when I wasn't worth $2,000.
$25,000. That was a lot of money then, wasn't it?
That was a lot of money then. So I organized the co-op. I was financier. I was general manager. I was field supervisor. I was selling, in charge of sales, buying equipment. We operated on $30 an acre less, so that a 10-acre farmer, then, in addition to that, I said, boys, if we can put up a U.S. number one grade potato, I can get you 50 cents above the market on your potatoes. Sure, we'll do that. Yeah, the damn rascals. And they ran, all the potatoes were run by hand graders in those days. They ran them over so fast that the number twos had to go in with the number ones. And I said, boys, that ain't going to do. If I'm going to get you 50 cents above the market, they got to be 95% number ones in that barrel. Well, they got mad, of course. But I stuck to my guns, and I called up a buyer, and I had three cars or four on the tracks. Bunnell, and say I got three cars of U.S. number ones on the track. All the buyers said, do you say they're U.S. number ones? And I said, I do. Never had a complaint. 50 cents a package above the market. Well, no wonder the farmers liked it, because the fellow across the fence with the factors in a poor price year wouldn't have a cent for his year's crop. My farmer across the fence, 40 barrels average crop, 50 cents a package, that's $20. With the $30 on operating costs, my little fellow across the fence pocketed $500. The other fellow with his 10 acres got nothing. See, there's a difference.
Yeah.
So they liked that, and that was another.
Yes. And you did that for 3 years.
I did that for 3 years.
I don't know how you survived. There's so much work in it, Mr. Nealon.
Boy, was I driving my car thousands of miles every year for them for nothing. And that bunch of crooks around the courthouse and the bank in Bunnell can't catch on to Nealon's racket. He ain't doing all that for nothing. Don't give me that. He's getting his somewhere, but I can't figure out where he gets it.
Is that?
They didn't ever suspect somebody might be making an honest effort.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Oh, shoot.
Mm.
So, Mr. Nealon, you heard that cup, took that, finished off his cup of coffee. He hadn't been drinking it, really. He finished off his cup of coffee and pushed back, and he was ready to go, except he still would have lingered. I never saw such marvelous talk. And if I hadn't insisted on it, he wouldn't come in, and he has already forgotten that he's recording. And I tried to pin him down to another engagement this afternoon or tonight or tomorrow afternoon. He got so much to do. So I told him Faye would call his wife and they would arrange something.
That they tried to put in these catalpa trees, but they wouldn't work?
No, they wouldn't work. I made about 13 plantings of 300 trees each, from Pensacola to Okeechobee, and there are some forest trees that you shouldn't plant in pure stands. And maybe they should all be planted in mixed stands. I feel like the man, you know, that's on television at the Shell Oil Company. You never know what. Shut up.
Well, if I don't check, you know.
Something like that. A man puts out an honest effort and then goes to the Flinders.
Yeah, that's a whole summer.
That's
2 or 3 months.
It's a shame.
Well, a man ought to have. What happened to the catalpas?
Well, they are a peculiar tree, and I can't understand it myself, and nobody else seems to come up with an answer. But there's a root rot that is called Rhizoctonia solani, and if it catches a tree or two in a 300-tree planting, pretty soon through underground root contact, the first 4 years they do fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they begin to make root contact, they begin to die back.
Well, you know, these...
Well, how many do you have together there?
Oh, 3 or 4 right out here.
Are they close enough to make root contact, 6 or 8 feet or 10?
Yeah.
Well, if it's that what it is, why... But the I got the idea through East Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Kansas, and then easterly to Pennsylvania. Those people, Tennessee, they grow catalpas. But that's Catalpa speciosa, and ours, southern Catalpa, is Catalpa bignoniardis. Now,
they don't have any trouble at all up there.
No, I noticed that. I used to see him at a distance in Kansas, and I'd say, well, there's another farmer. He must have made a nursery, a pecan nursery. Didn't have any sale for his stock. And then I got close enough and found out they were catalpas, the fence post planting. So I decided I'd try it too, but it didn't work.
Well, you know, that's the trouble. I don't have any soft wood down here, you see, nothing but pine.
Yeah.
Hardwood, whatever you call it.
Hardwood. Every broadleaf tree is classified among foresters as a hardwood. Even though cottonwood is a softer wood than most pine, it's still classified as a hardwood. So if you want to know what they're talking about when they say hardwood, it's a broadleaf tree, not a cedar or a pine or spruce or a fir or a hemlock or a redwood or any of those. They're all considered softwood.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our slash pine, for instance, is harder than most many hardwoods. Of course, not like old, because I never found catalpa growing naturally south of Alachua County, from here north and west.
Mm-hmm.
And never found a grove anywhere, only singly among the hardwoods. And one here and way over yonder another one. And maybe nature's way of growing southern catalpa.
Yeah.
But it's the world's best fence post.
Is that right?
Oh, my God, last 2 or 3 creosote posts.
I don't find those creosote posts last long, Mr.
They're not all well penetrated. And some of our dense pine down here is a little difficult to get penetrated. Now, I was out experimentation the other day, and someone had left a short length, a dump, threw it out on the dump of creosoted post, and I said, well, I need some stakes that are durable, so I carried it home and split it. It had about an inch, maybe an inch and a half of creosote, and the rest was white heartwood and beginning to rot.
Yeah. Well, now these posts just rot off even with the ground.
They do?
Yeah.
Even with the ground.
That
must not have been a good job of creosote for some reason.
That's what I just, you could just walk down these fences and just see one right after another.
Good fence posts are a problem, and I was hoping to do something for farmers by making plantings, because you'll get a fence post in 10 years, and the other next best post would be red cedar, and the plantings I made, you wouldn't get much of a post in 25 years, because only the heartwood of any tree is durable. The sapwood isn't, but a catalpa that is 4 inches in diameter will make you a post, because the sapwood is cardboard thin.
Oh.
It's all hard on.
Oh.
90%.
Is that right?
I said, well, that's the tree you recommend, because
yeah.
1,000 posts cost you $1,000, and they don't go too far, and the farmers don't like to put out that much money for fence.
Well, that's a lot
and
of
that's
money.
That's creosoted, and they're not even good.
Not even good.
A catalpa post is worth $2 if the creosoted post is worth $1.
Yeah. Well, if you could get them to last just long enough.
Far enough away, remote from others, it might have carried the disease.
Yeah.
And I'm rather generously in the planting because of their value.
Mm-hmm.
And those, in 10 years, have made posts. So, two posts per tree, that tree is worth $2.
Yeah.
What forest tree do you plant that in 10 years is worth
$2? Yes, yes.
Counting
and you can
only,
plant so many of them.
Yeah, counting only a dollar a post.
Yeah.
And they're worth more if a creosoted post is
worth
a dollar.
What happened to that co-op you were talking about, Mr. Neal, this morning?
Oh, I managed the thing for them for 3 years.
It's all right.
Is it okay? Has it been working?
Yeah.
It's working now, so I'll be spoiling something.
No, it's all right.
When I started there, I said, well, that's a pretty difficult thing. And at the same time I started, the Hastings Potato Growers Association was organized. And so I went up and copied their charter, and the first thing I did was ask the manager there, good man, Homer L. Robinson, if he wouldn't take our members in, too.
Where was that?
In Hastings. That's
oh, yes.
It was 35,
yeah.
40 miles north of where
yeah.
we were. And he said, no, if you've got any cooperative spirit down there, you develop it, and we'll take you in if
mm-hmm.
they prove up.
Well, now, was he the county agent?
No, he was, had nothing to do with the county agent. He was employed by the potato growers at a good $2,500 a year salary.
Full time.
Full time, you bet, and it was a big job.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I'll go back and do what I can then on my own hook. But he helped me.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me the benefit of his trainload purchases. And for cash there, you could buy much cheaper.
Oh, yeah.
And so we could pay our 8% to the bank and still come out so much better than paying 40% to the factories or the banks, local banks, who finance the crop.
Yeah.
So I managed for 3 years, and I said, boys, I've got other things to do. The county agent can't just be riding herd on potato growers. And they said he's throwed us down. I said, no. We had a good old southern man down there. He could read and write, but that's all. But he was sharp, and best of all, he was honest.
Yeah.
And he was our president. And I said, Mr. Riley Mulfers and I will campaign this county, and if we can get 1,000 acres of cooperative potatoes here, we can join direct with Hastings. And we did. We got over 1,000 acres. And then I got out from under, because then they had to pay $2.50 an acre for the service I'd been giving them free.
Yeah.
And
well, that wasn't much.
No, when you're saving $30, $40, and $50 per acre, well, that's a small matter.
Yeah.
Oh, well, they were glad enough to do that. So then the great trouble was the next year, the Depression came on, 1929.
Uh-oh.
There wasn't any money in the agricultural fund, and I didn't get my $60 a month for 5 months. But I worked on, because the farmers were loyal, and they had a lot of unfinished business, but you can't raise a family on $60 a month, even if you have a cow and some chickens in a small garden.
Yeah.
So I worked on until Forest Service was organized here in 1928.
Mm-hmm.
And I organized the first, as county agent down there, the first 4-H forestry clubs in Florida. And I was promoting it because if you'd asked me when I was 7 years old what I wanted to be, I'd have told you I wanted to be a forester.
Oh, is that right?
Because that was my big interest.
Yeah.
And no forestry schools for a poor country boy. They only had one in Yale.
Yeah.
So I put in my application out there in the early days, back in 1967. You could get in with the U.S. Forest Service on their national forest. As a forest guard, and from that it depended on you. You could work yourself up to higher positions.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as I told you, the family moved south, and that was all forgotten. And the only thing I got was a little agricultural education, and that was it, except
mm-hmm.
this. I did take international correspondence school courses in English and math, and took summer school courses while I was working there.
Oh.
But just before I could get my bachelor's, I got into World War One.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're 30 and past, it's a little too late to go back to school. So my education is, academically, I'm nobody. as I say, you need something to go with your. Some places they are, yes, they have been very successful. California has a number of them now, the world's best. But oh, did I have trouble with my co-op members. First year, I figured out where we could get. So many of them lived back in the country, was connected to Crescent Lake with the St. John's River, and 10 miles to the nearest railway station. So to get our supplies, I got an old friend who used to play baseball with him, Bill Miller, who had a barge land at Jacksonville to deliver right to within 2 to 3 miles of their farm. So I made that proposition to him, and I said, if that'll be all right with you fellas, I would always thoroughly democratic. We decided everything at a meeting at night at a little schoolhouse there.
Yeah.
Well, yes, sir, that would be just fine. Well, I said, this is the proposition. His barges can't carry all of the seed and fertilizer in one trip. He has to make one trip this week and one trip the next week. It's a long way by barge and a small motor launch. Well, that would be perfectly all right. So we decided that night, and I went back, and the lights went out, and I went back to my little Model T car. To go home, out of the dark comes the president and the vice president. And the president says, I want all my seed and supplies on that first barge. Well, the vice president spoke up and said, and mine too, mind you.
Is that right?
And I was in charge of everything. You know, that made me boil, but I tried to control myself. I said, look here, boys, just because you're president and vice president, the rest of the boys would like you to take advantage of them. They have disappeared. So I thought maybe I had cured them.
Yeah.
I had a man down there checking out, and I couldn't be up there day and night, and you have to sleep.
Yeah.
So I left the man in charge, gave him, the old fellow, he used to tickle me, he said, now, so-and-so's got his fuchsia. I don't think he had too much English either. He meant quota, you know. And so-and-so's gotten his. But those two rascals hauled all night and got all theirs first.
Yeah.
And I didn't think they'd do that.
Yeah.
So I wasn't there, so that's what they did. I'd have knocked them into the lake if I'd been at the dock. But they got by with it. Next morning, I was down there early, and one of the farmers came in there with his two horses and wagon to get his, and they were gone. Get his supplies, and they were gone. And he turned around to the president who was there, old man Reynolds. He says, is that the way you cooperate? Snatch, grab everything.
Yeah.
So he caught a ride home, Reynolds did, with me. because he lived a half mile down the road, and I didn't like the way that man talked. You know, I said, well, can you blame him? He came down to get his supplies as he should have, and you had hauled them.
Yeah.
And then he got mad at me, and those two fought me from then on to every way they could.
Yeah.
So I said, boys, when we had the next meeting, as long as those two fellas are in there, I am not managing anymore. Oh, boy, that got them upset. And so I recommended this old backwoods man for president. And after that, things went on. And those fellas kept on making trouble until we had another meeting. We first suspended them for a year. We had another meeting and kicked them out completely.
Yeah.
Always remember old man Riley. Fred then met him one time in Bunnell, the county seat town, and this old man Reynolds came up here, and I said, yeah, I'm going to fight you. I'm going to fight you till I ruin that organization. And old man Riley says, I'm all right, Mr. Reynolds, plumb all right. Shit, if you can do it, it'd be plumb all right. They failed completely, and we made a success of it.
Well, Mr. Nealon, look here. I somehow got the idea that you had more skinflints in Florida than you did in those other states up ahead of us here.
You had more what?
Skinflints.
Oh.
Troublemakers.
I don't think it's so much different. I don't know. Morals are at a pretty low ebb in this country. It seems that for a dollar, people will sell their souls. It's a shame.
I don't know. They was raised up down here on...
Well, it'll cost you money to put them in. Not as much as some crops, but it'll cost you something. And you hate to come out a loser.
Yeah.
But it's...
You see, it's reset.
Trucking is a tricky business.
Yes. That's right. Anywhere you take it.
Anywhere you take it. We had a bull story this morning. Did you know I had another bull story?
No.
We moved back there, you know, as I told you, the young man might be interested in the definition down there. It's this wild country. When we moved down there to farm.
Yeah.
And, range cattle and wild hogs in the woods, as I said this morning, was the principal way those old-timers made a living, open range.
Yeah.
Everything belonged to them. But we cleared up our 20 acres and went to truck farming there. Well, the range cattle were not milk cows.
Yeah.
By any means. They were scrawny, tick-ridden critters that looked bad. They were just products of the poor range.
They never got any attention, did they?
No, except the only attention they got in a good year, along about May or June, they got fat enough because they burned the woods and the grass would be green enough to fatten them up and they'd sell what was saleable. They didn't need much to make a living.
Yeah.
So that sort of the thing. Well, we had a luck to get about a half-blooded Jersey heifer for our farm because we wanted to have some milk cows that would produce milk, not like a teacup full of them from the range cattle. If the dogs brought them up and they got about a teacup full of milk at a time from the cow. So it came time that young heifer got in heat. And I didn't find it out till the critter jumped the fence. And Dad was there, and I said, we got to get that heifer back in here. She'll get bred to that miserable old scrawny bull that's following her, and we won't have a milk cow as a calf. So I said, well, I'll have to catch her, but that bull was wild, you know. And so I hastily knotted up two new plow lines, 30-foot plow lines, new cotton plow line rope. And I'm no great chaser of the lasso, you know. I'm no roper, but you do a little of it out on the range there. We did have some stock in the west. So I said, maybe I can sneak up close enough to rope that critter, because as long as he's with that bull, the two just tear through the piney woods and I can't get close to him. Can't get him separated.
Yeah.
So I got my lines and I rolled them up and put a slip knot in it. And And then I followed and sneaked and followed, and every time I got close enough to heave, why, they'd start to run again. But finally, my dad was off about 40 yards behind, and finally, I slipped up on the heifer's side, and the bull was on the other side, a miserable, spotted up, brindle-looking thing. So I said, well, now maybe I can catch that thing. So here was the heifer standing, and here was the bull behind her, and he didn't see what I was bent over sneaking up on. And so when I got within range, about 45 feet or something like that, I threw my rope, and it circled around all right, and it would have settled over that heifer's head. But while that rope was in transit, that bull stepped about 5 feet ahead of the heifer, and I had him instead of the heifer. Wild critter. Well.
And you couldn't get it off.
I couldn't get it off, so I braced my heels, and that critter went round, round, round the full length of the rope and couldn't get away, and shot you now. I didn't want to lose that rope. I couldn't afford that. Dad would have said, you're a fine one to help us out on that situation.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's the story. After he found out he couldn't get away, he got a foolish notion. He charged me like
and you didn't have your...
Didn't have my pitchfork. Well, you know, I don't have much time to think. So I made off in those flat woods, and about 60 yards away was a pine sapling that the loggers had left, a thin thing, about 8 inches or 10 in diameter, but way up there, a little top. Well, that was the only thing I could see for protection, and I took off. And I could hear him behind me, rumpity-rumpity-rump, and the head. You know, I don't think I ever ran that fast in my life, and I don't think I ever had that much incentive. Anyway, I beat him to the tree. And when I got to the tree, I got behind the tree, and he had plenty of horns. He kept going around the tree after me, and I found out pretty quick that 2 feet can get around the tree shorter than four.
Yeah.
So something must have preoccupied my mind. I'd never let go of that rope. I still had it in my hand. And he'd go round and round and round. First thing you know, he wound himself up and suddenly snubbed when he got the end of the rope. He was wound up, and he fell down flat. And I stood over him, and he's rolling his eyes. I said, well, now I'm time. The critter will get after me again. Now what can I do? And while I was puzzled there, he suddenly gets his head a jerk like that and popped the rope right at his horn and got up, and he'd had enough of me. He ran away. You know,
yeah.
An animal like that, he thought I knocked him down, you know, and he thought I was a better man, so he had enough of me. He ran off, trotted off in the woods, and I got my heifer back, driven back home.
You know, I've watched these big cows with horns down here at the livestock market.
Yeah.
And you know, there in the middle, they got that little place there where a fella can stand if he wants to.
Yeah.
Now, they don't seem to be able to reach way up high. It's just the length of the height of their horns.
Yeah, that's about the range, and they usually hook lower.
Yeah. Yeah,
much lower.
Yeah. So if you can get up just a little piece, you're all right.
Oh, you'd be all right. But that tree, I didn't have time to climb it.
Yeah.
All I could do is get behind it, and then he chased me around and around.
Yeah.
But I think I was lucky. I turned around and looked there, and there was Dad still looking. And I said to myself, I ought to charge him 50 cents for the show.
Well.
But I got the heifer.
If you just had a, if you got a stump. If you stand on a stump.
Yeah, he might have knocked my legs out from under me.
Yeah,
he probably would have. He'd have hooked what he could hook, what he could reach.
Yeah.
But he'd sure killed that nigger if I hadn't saved him.
Yeah.
He was that kind. I had some students come down sometimes to help me at different times, and I told them, don't you ever go in that lot without a pitchfork now, this young boy. And so he did. And I was in the shop doing some work, and I heard him say, "Get out of here, get out of here, get out of here." And here was that bull stalking him. And you know, he must have been a dude, because there he was standing like this with a pitchfork and pushing it down. And that bull was watching his chance to rush him.
Oh.
And there was a fork in the corner of the shop, and I saw what was happening. I grabbed it and ran out of the shop towards the bull. As soon as he saw me, he sold out.
He remembers that, huh?
He remembers. You know, they're pretty cute. They remember them. Well, he had something to remember, because he had a bad sore nose that day.
Well, let's see. After you... Was you still the county agent after the co-op business?
Oh, yes. I stayed there.
And then you got into the forestry side.
Well, the state foresters came down, and, you know, they were short of people who knew Florida woods and people and conditions. So I had done quite a bit about forest protection down there. In fact, I had made a talk before the faculty club here while I was working about the need for forest protection.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody thought I was a little touched in the head, but that might have been true. That wasn't, the subject wasn't the reason, but things were new in those days. And finally, I got some seedlings, some pine seedlings, and I got my boys to plant them, make a planting in the old farmer said, "Look at him, he's planting pines. You know they won't grow. They'll grow if they're yearlings, but if they're 3-year-old, they won't." So they had been planting 2-3-year-old trees. Of course, they all died. But mine...
I didn't know that, Mr. Neal.
Oh, yes. You can't plant a pine after it's old unless you plant it in a ball of earth intact.
Oh, I see. Sure.
Then you can plant them up to 2-3 feet tall.
Sure.
But
well, that'd do much trouble if you're going to plant many.
Well, you know, I was in a bad fix then to refuse when the state forester came down and said, "Well, if you're that much interested, you should be working for us." Well, I said, "Give me a week to think it over, and I'll," you know, he said, "take all the time you want, but let us know." So I thought it over for a week and went with him. Then I went to the board. Oh, that board was something, you know. I got into so much trouble up there. I was just trying to do the honest thing. Three members that controlled of the 5-member board were real estate people. And the big business then was to sell the Northern Yankees farmland in the back woods there. And they didn't know or care what kind of 40 acres they sold, and the miserable stuff that all the 36,000 acres of good farm soil in the county, but they move them out in some miserable flatwoods, the sour hard pan land, and the man would come by and say, "What about that? I've got a down payment on it. Is that all right? Is that good enough for all?" He may be from Maine. He might have been from Ohio or
I just want half an inch, huh?
Illinois or any other place. He wouldn't know. I'd say, "No, that is one of the poorest soil in the county, and I wouldn't even keep my payments up."
Hmm. And well, that's been going on
he'd
long.
He'd go to the board and tell him what I said. Out with him.
Yeah.
And they'd fire me fortnightly almost. It was something else.
Yeah.
And
now,
so,
now you were on the forester side then.
No, I was in agricultural work altogether.
Altogether.
All there, but my forestry work was just
on the side.
See, I was organized these 4-H forestry clubs. I had to get my information from Washington, D.C., how to organize the club because there was no state forester.
Yeah.
So when the state forester came down, he said, "You should be working for us if you're that much interested."
Yeah.
Of course, I knew something about the dirt here, about the soils, and what would produce and what wouldn't. And so I told the board that had been firing me so many times, you know, get into it in a funny way. One of my old professor friends here I knew well while I was a student, while I was working here, wrote me and he said, "My nephew up in Ohio has been approached by a salesman to buy a certain piece of land in your county."
Yeah.
And He said, I'd like your report on it. And so I said, that's the last time I wrote a confidential letter. I said, this is a confidential letter. I said, this looks to me like a fly-by-night organization. And it's wet, the land is wet and poorly drained.
Oh, it's good, huh?
Good land, but it's not well drained enough to farm.
Yeah.
And you know what the old prof did? He sent his nephew that letter. And the nephew handed it to the salesman.
Yeah.
And the salesman wrote to the chairman of the Board of County Commission and said, this is the kind of sales resistance we have in your county.
How about that?
But the fortunate part was an old farmer was chairman of the board temporarily at that time. And I usually met the board once a month and in case they wanted to ask any questions or if I had a report to make.
Yeah.
So this old farmer, he passed that letter under the table to me.
Yeah.
And he said, what shall I do with that? So I looked at it and saw there was a copy of the letter I wrote to the old professor. Passed it back under, said, throw it in the waste paper basket. That's what I thought. So I escaped that time. He knew
that,
what I had said was just about.
That's confidential.
Because he lived close by there, near in that community at least. So, but when I finally went before the board and told them that I was retiring as of the first of the month to take out the work, well, that same crowd that fired me so often said, is there anything this board could do to cause you to reconsider? You know, after you haven't been paid for 5 months and no chance to know, no knowing if you'd ever get paid.
Yeah.
But I finally got my $300. I came through Bunnell and saw the clerk while I was in the Forest Service. They made me district forester over 12 counties.
Oh.
And I said, hi, Bill, how are things going? Oh, about the same. That was 4 years after I retired there. And he said, but you know, there's a little money in the agricultural fund. Maybe the county could pay you what it owes you. I said, that's good news. Is the chairman in town? Yeah, he said, I saw him down the street a little while ago. So I found the chairman and got a voucher signed, went to the bank and walked off with $300, my 5 months pay.
How long afterwards?
4 years. That depression just hit it.
Mr. Nealon, the courthouse crowd, they were just sort of waiting for a chance.
Oh, sure. That, those three, the balance of power. It was a crooked outfit. There was one member of the board, though, he was honest, and he said, no, boy, you can't get away with that. That's not a square deal. They're using the taxpayers' money to develop their city. There are lots on the beach.
Yeah.
And you know what they did? They didn't do it to me. They got a bunch of thugs from Palm Beach to come up there. When he stepped out of church one night, put a sack over his head, took him 10 miles out in the woods, and over a log, and beat the tar out of the old man.
Why, Mr. Neal?
And told him, and he came back. He's a great little Georgian, and he wouldn't quit.
Yeah.
So about 2 months later, he stepped out of the post office one morning, grabbed him, sack over his head, threw him in the car, took him out and beat him up again in the woods and told him if they came back again, they'd kill him. And his wife got so hysterical, he had to leave town. But that's the kind of crowd we had down there.
Well, when they, you know, when they're charging so much interest and charging above the price for all this stuff.
Yeah, so much goes on. It's
now, that was just constant.